Okay, so let's start today. So I'm just reviewing the topic about operant symmetry and spinors. Operant symmetry we discussed that there's the combination of Lorentz transformations and translations. And the Lorentz transformations happen to be homomorphic to the group SL2C, 2 by 2 matrices. And that the fundamental representation of that group, that's what defines left-handed spinor. And this is, to be clear, we call that left-handed bias spinor. It's not complete. Dirac spinor for Lorentz. And the conjugate representation then defines the right-handed spinor. And they, I told you, the AB notation of here, this is a 1/2 0, this is 0 1/2 spinner, and they are both related by parity, that justifies the name of left and right handed. And again, for each of the two, the sigma mean use and the sigma bar mean use happen to be the generators of the set to C group. Good. Any questions so far? So I will try to finish this technical subject today, and then I'll do it. Before getting to the fun part, I have to suffer a little bit. So let's try some identities. For those of you who have taken the symmetries course, I think you have seen them. I've written them, but we introduce them for the rest of the course. Then and then trace sigma sigma bar is equal to 2 times u. Sigma u alpha of the top. It's an interesting identity that tells you that the matrix sigma, they have a constraint that the you multiply by the epsilon tensor for the matrix, so you back the same sigma, and that is a property of all self-dual. Dual is because of multiplication by epsilon, multiplication by epsilon, and since it gives you back sigma, so that's called self-dual. Whereas the sigma bars are anti-self-dual. Sense that they have the same relation over the minus sign. So identities, if you haven't worked this out, it would be fun to try it just to get your hand free with the calculations. There is a book that sometimes I hesitate to recommend because it makes a lot of calculations, but if you are interested for all these things, I will mention it just in case. As a reference, it's an old book, it's called Supersymmetries. And the authors are very old, and even the questions are written with a handwriting. But they go all the details of the Galilean equation. So you want to have all the things of minus signs and so on. That's a good reference to try, just to, if you want to you're stuck in some calculation, that may help. As you saw with this very detailed things, that there are some mistakes in the equation. So don't trust everything you see. But I think it's really quite useful if you want to see how the calculations are done in this dimension of the speed of the point. Okay. So then we'll continue with some product of spinners. The first is that you have the product of two spinners side to side, defined to be psi alpha, in this order, which is important. And this, of course, is just you lower the index, this index and raise that index by using epsilon. That would be psi alpha. Similarly, for the conjugate spinners, the product is the same but following the order in the opposite direction. So now you contract from bottom to up. Just convention, so there's not that much to understand here, except that you will see why it's convenient to find it in this way. In particular, particular, we have the product of two spinors, or the spinor by itself, so psi squared. Psi. That would be, and according to this, that would be psi alpha. Which is, I can write this as epsilon alpha distance. Alpha theta, psi theta, psi alpha. And if we use the definition of epsilon, which is the total anti-symmetric tensor, that happens to be, that will give you psi 2, psi 1, minus psi 1, psi 2. Okay. So that means that the square of a spinor gives you this difference of those two terms. This is one motivation to choose now this number, this spinor numbers, to be anti-commuting. If they were commuting, psi 2, psi 1 equals to psi 1, psi 2, the square of the spinor would be 0. So that's not very exciting. So we will choose the other way around. We will choose the psi 2 and the psi as components as to be Grassmann numbers, the numbers which are anti-commuting. So it's a convention, so that means that psi 1, psi 2 equals to minus psi 2, psi 1. Okay. Or in general, we can write psi alpha, psi beta, b, psi hat, epsilon alpha beta, times. This leads to some further identities. Here's identity set of psi equals to. Sorry, I forgot. There's something that isn't the commuting property of the spinors implies then that psi will then be equal to, then you change this order, there will be psi alpha chi alpha with the minus sign, so that will be equal to psi chi. Okay. Did you get that? This is very important. So this is in general, up to here we didn't know they were anti-commuting. If they're anti-commuting, I change the order, then it will be psi chi, which is the order, give you a bigger minus sign. And then we have that. Okay. And so on. Also, we have then we can define the dagger. Say that psi dagger is equal to theta bar psi bar and psi sigma g theta dagger equals to psi sigma g psi bar. And this it's just the properties of all the spinners and the complex and the sigma matrices. What you have to know about the dagger needs for a spinner, and for dagger we're using this psi alpha dagger. It's just psi bar alpha dot. And also, for future use, it's good to know that psi bar alpha dot can be obtained from the corresponding spinner by complex conjugating and multiplying by the matrix sigma 0. So this is just a way of controlling the indices notation. Remember that sigma 0 is just identity. So this is just identity times the corresponding spinner complex conjugated. So that brings you from the complex conjugation to the dotted notations. So just that changes from theta to alpha dot. Okay, so you use this definition and then that will be true. Okay, so to close this, let me just write a connection to the Dirac spinners. Okay, so far I introduced for you the two component spinners, and they have to be related to the more standard spinners that we deal with in quantum computing, which are the Dirac spinners. And for that, you can define the gamma mu matrices to be 0, sigma mu, sigma mu bar 0. I know the properties of the sigma mu. This implies that this gamma matrix satisfies the following parameters. So that means that this gamma matrix is defined in this way are a representation of the Dirac algebra. Also, that defines the gamma mu's, and then the gamma phi is defined to be gamma 0, 1, 2, 3. And if you just use this definition of the gamma, this will give you minus the identity in two dimensions, 0. Dimensions. And of course this gamma phi has eigenvalues plus or minus 1, and that is what is defined as chirality. Gamma mu I have forgotten a minute to be the subject, which I call sigma minute, which is the diagonal. What you mentioned is defined by the sigmas and sigma bars, which are the generators of SL2C. And then, because of that property, these sigma minus are the generators of Lorentz space. In the sense that since sigma and sigma bar satisfy the algebra, then the capital sigma also satisfies the algebra. From here we define the max spinner. The max spinner psi d, we define it to be the pair psi alpha chi bar alpha dot. So we combine the left-handed and the right-handed bias spinner, and that will give you the Dirac spinner. So we can, well, not that, if since gamma phi, we can apply gamma phi to this Dirac spinner, and that will give us minus psi alpha chi bar alpha dot. So then we can have the projector project or P L one half minus gamma five and P right be 1/2 alpha gamma five. Such that then P left acting on the Dirac spinner, this will give this will cancel this part and will give that, so that that will give you just the bias spinner psi alpha 0 and P right acting on the Dirac spinner. That will give you only the right hand component of the Dirac spinner. So again, this is this will be left-handed. That will be right-handed spinners. Finally, we define the conjugate psi Dirac bar to be just the world object. Like that. This can be seen to be zero. Then we just make this into a column object. I call it this conjugate C. That is alpha. This happens to be just the matrix C times psi bar B, where C is a matrix of the epsilon vectors. And this is the complex, the charge conjugation. that's what essentially what changes you particles to antiparticles. That's what the conjugate is, essentially. So we will see that, for instance, if a psi Dirac satisfies the Dirac equation with a positive sign for the electric charge, the psi D conjugate will satisfy the same equation with the opposite sign for the electric charge. So that will define the conjugate particle. And then, the last thing is the Majorana spinors. Is you take a Dirac spinner and set chi alpha equals psi alpha chi alpha. That means that the Majorana spinner psi n you can write that as psi alpha psi bar alpha dot. So now these two objects are the same. One is the complex conjugate of the other. That's just so it's assigned a Majorana spinner with a reality property, so it's like a real object. And in fact, psi A, you use the definition of the complex of the conjugate spinner that happens to be equals to its conjugate. So that's why it's a real object. So at any, in the same way that we can decompose a Dirac spinner in terms of a right-handed and left-handed value spinners, we can also decompose any Dirac spinners in terms of a Majorana components. So we can always write a Dirac spinner to be psi Majorana 1 plus I psi. In that regard, then the conjugate Dirac spinner will be minus I. And so this is a property of Majorana spinner. So we have seen five Majorana and Dirac spinners. We can ask the question if there is a spinner which is both Majorana and Weyl in four dimensions. But this will not happen. So notice. No. Majorana Weyl. In 4D. I emphasize that this is in 4D. That means that you want to have a spinner that is both Majorana and Weyl. If it is Weyl, that means that one of the components is zero here. But if it is Majorana, both components are equal. So that means that they would both be zero. So there's no spin. Okay. That's the thing. That you cannot be both at the same time Majorana and Weyl. Is that clear? Yeah.
What is the meaning of the Majorana decomposition?
Sorry, what is the
zero? Physical meaning of the decomposition of the Majorana.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's good to treat. In general, you can have some reality components of the spinner. That's an informal. But for instance, in practice, people have talked about the principle of neutrino being a chargeless particle can be real. It can be a Majorana. That's you can have that kind of implication. So it's good to have in mind what kind of you have. Remember that the charged objects are usually complex, but neutral objects can be real. So then people say, well, then the neutrino could be a Majorana particle. Okay, so. Whereas, as it's good to you pointed out, that whereas the Weyl spinners are very physical because we know that the world is separated between left and right. So we know that there's difference between left and right. And you will see that the standard models, elements in the standard model are definitely left handed, or right handed. Okay, so this is the end of this book. I think this is difficult. This was difficult for me because for some of you, this is the end time that you have seen these kind of things. For others, this is the first time. And for the ones that is the first time, it's very difficult. For the ones that is the fourth time, it's very boring. So I try to make it fast, at least to diminish the suffering. And but please come to me. There's those of you thought that it's very fast, that you miss some things. Please come to me and ask me questions. Okay. So good. So now we'll move to the next chapter. So before starting talking about the formal aspects of our supersymmetry, I have to tell you about the history. So this started in a time that there was a lot of confusion, and people were doing kind of a lot of crazy things. And that means that it's in the 60s. So in the 60s there were many things going on. And in particular for our field, people were doing classification of particles regarding the different quantum numbers and put them into multiples. For instance, there was this idea of I think Heisenberg and this isospin idea, I'm sure you have heard about that, that you can define a symmetrical isospin, which was an SU2, for which a neutron and a proton were different states of that. It would be like different spin states with respect to that symmetry with isospin. So essentially, that would explain why the neutron and the proton would be so close in mass.
Oh, and that was Kammann.
What's Kammann?
Kammann.
Kammann. Oh, thank you.
Kammann.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Okay. Good. Thank you. And then people started using the symmetry arguments, and came up with a bigger symmetry. Instead of SU2, consider SU3. And SU3, you can classify particles in bigger multiples. Instead of just having two particles in one multiple, now you can have bigger multiples of octets or decuplets and so on. That was SU3, and that was the famous eightfold way of Gell-Mann and Niemann. And that was a nice way, given so many particles. Right? This time there were hundreds of particles being discovered, all these resonances and so on, and hadrons in general. And so they wanted to put them in some order, to classify them in some way. And so SU3 was very successful. And but in SU3, every single multiple, octets, decuplets, and so on, they happen to be of the same spin. So it was an octuplet of mesons and so on, but some of the variables, but they were all the difference. Within one multiple, they all have the same spin. So then people say, well, what about having symmetries that mix spins? So you have in one bigger multiple that puts two of those multiples together, one octet with the spin. One or spin zero, so one of the spin one half, so. And So they were postulating bigger symmetries, like SU6, this kind of thing. But and actually had some mixture of, they were missing spin and say an SU3 symmetry. So that was the idea at that time, that they can evolve symmetries that mixes the internal symmetries, which were like isospin or the SU3, with the space-time symmetry, the one that give you spin. So we have multiplets for which probably because of this different spin would be in the same multiple. So that was what people were doing in the 60s. So they were studying the strong interaction because the hadrons that were there. Now we're given the big multiplicity of particles. And so as I said, the particles were successfully classified, organized in multiples. Of SU3, which is what we now recognize as SU3 flavor. And the question was, can there be bigger multiples including different spins? Especially with non-relativistic models, and they wanted to see if this would be extended to relativistic models. However, in 1967, something very exciting happened. You know what happened in 1967? The Beatles came with the Sgt. Pepper's. Che Guevara was killed. What else happened? Magritte died. There was this war of the 6 days. Actually, Weinberg, closer to us, Weinberg came up with a famous paper that defines the standard model. That was 1967. So there were a lot of things happening. And probably because of that, people didn't realize that there was this occurring. Supposing Emanuel. Goldman and Mandula, they have what is called as a noble theory for this question. So they said that this was not possible. That's it. So, the thing is that they try to look for the most general symmetry of scattering amplitudes that included the space-time symmetries and internal symmetries. And they concluded that the most general symmetry of the asymmetries and is the scattering metric that it gives you the amplitudes and the interactions of particles was just simply a direct product, boring kind of direct product of Poincaré symmetry times internal symmetry. Okay. So that means here you will have all the commutation relations between the generators mu and mu that I mentioned before. And here you have the generators that I call the PA. Well, these generators were scalars with respect to the space-time symmetry. So essentially, they will have an algebra by themselves, maybe a big algebra or whatever, but they will just commute with all the space-time generators. And that means that there will not be any way to mix one single multiple things of a different spins, because they will just commute with the internal symmetries. So you have as big a symmetry you want here, but in every multiple, everything would have the same state. So that is the content of the Kalman-Mandula theorem. And you could have imagined that probably people would have tried to use that as a way to guide themselves to how to change the assumptions of the theorem and generalize it. However, people essentially this played no role at all, this theorem, for a while. So people actually probably they were ignorant about it, or they didn't care. But at least it didn't have any influence in the discoverers of Steiner. This happened in 1971. That was an interesting year also. What happened in 1971? Katie Castle died from here.
Did Nixon and Bell come by here?
Yeah. a lot of activity regarding the Vietnam War. And I think there was a war in India and Pakistan. And so a lot of things were going on there. And again, for us, the most important part that happened that year is the work of in the Soviet Union at that time, Wolfgang and Dickman. They were just doing something just purely algebraic. What they did is just to extend it. Poincaré algebra. To include Skinner generation. Alpha, or alpha is the index we have been using for spin. So that means that the Poincaré algebra that had only vector-like and tensor-like objects, they just play with it by a theorem to say that they were working in string theory. In string theory, at that time, they were worried about including spinners in string theory, which happened to be two-dimensional. Object, because of the two-dimensional field theory, which is the worship of the string, two-dimensional object. So they introduced spinners in two dimensions to include them into the formulation of the string theory. And that was supersymmetric two dimensions. So from the string theory. So it was nice to see that even from its origins, string theory has played an important role with supersymmetry and having a close relationship between both. In 1973, what happened in 1973? It was the beginning of the Watergate scandal, I think. What has happened? Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon. What are things happening? And at that time, the Volkov and Akimov. Again, in the Soviet Union, apparently without knowing the work of Dolph and Lichtman, they were speculating that they were trying to understand why the neutrino was a massless particle. It was looked to be a massless particle at that time. And there was a nice result in the past due to Goldstone that you would see in the standard model course, which is that there are natural massless bosons as the origin of the because of some symmetries that are the Boltzmann bosons. So So they were thinking that probably the fact that the neutrinos were massless was because of a symmetry, because of a broken symmetry. And so they tried to have the neutrinos. As Gaussian particles. That means that that explained that the mass was zero. And that was a very nice idea because for usually in a standard symmetry, these Gaussian particles being massless, and both Gaussians are bosons, therefore Gaussian bosons. And they came out, so there has to be a symmetry that implies that they have to be Gaussian fermions, because the neutrinos are fermions. And that also was the sense that the origin of they discovered not only supersymmetry but also how to break supersymmetry. Supersymmetry breaking. And again, this is completely unrelated to the previous one. So it was, it's curious to see everything so close in time, which were being unrelated. However, what we consider the real beginning of supersymmetry is in 1974. 1974 is the work of Wes and Titus Wes and Smino. Wes and Smino, they actually, I think they knew now the work of Ramon et al. In two dimensions. And they said, well, this symmetry is very beautiful, so let's see if there is something in four dimensions where we can have actually field theories with supersymmetry. So they started the supersymmetric this year. D4D. And it was actually this work of Wes and Smino, a series of papers, very impressive, that actually this boosted the interest of most of the final energy community into supersymmetry. First just by just formal things, and then people realized that they had some applications to phenomenology. That was realized several years later, in 1977 and then in the 80s mostly. But I think for most people this is the breakthrough in the sense that this is the paper that, or the set of papers that imply that how supersymmetry could be used in effectively in field theories, and then they explore all the beautiful properties of supersymmetry that we will observe and we start discussing next. I can have only 3 minutes. I don't have that much to say to start the next thing, the technical thing. So I better stop here and